This is James Corbett, and you're tuned into CorbettReport.com on this 23rd day of July 2010. Today I'm joined on the line across the international dateline by Will Thomas, the researcher and journalist behind such seminal works as Bringing the War Home on Gulf War Syndrome and Chemtrails Confirmed on the toxic pollutants being sprayed into our atmosphere. His work is available at willthomasonline.net. Will Thomas, thank you very much for joining me on the program today.
Pleasure to be with you and your listeners, James.
Well, Mr. Thomas, for those listeners out there who may not be aware of your work, you are one of the leading chemtrail researchers, having been following the story since the 1990s and having even coined the term chemtrail itself, which I understand some researchers have various issues with. But nonetheless, your work has obviously been central to the spreading of the awareness of this phenomenon and what may or may not be behind it. So just to establish the backstory, let's hear a little bit about your own background and how you came to start covering this story.
Well, I've been an investigative journalist for, oh my goodness, since the 1970s. So we're up 30, 40 years now as an investigative reporter. I've won awards for my work. I tend to cover the stories, James, that mainstream media refuses to look at. You mentioned the Gulf War illness, of course, the chemtrails major story, 9/11. I wrote the first published book on 9/11 and a sequel, one of the most recent books on 9/11, Days of Deception. Ground Zero and beyond. I was asked to look into these strange lines in the sky by the managing editor of Environment News Service. This is a worldwide wire service. Back in the winter of 97, and in January 98, I broke the chemtrails story, not calling them chemtrails at that time, but I broke the story for ENS, and shortly thereafter was on Art Bell Coast to Coast, and did many subsequent radio shows with Art Bell. I don't claim to have coined the word chemtrails. I certainly did popularize that word in my initial stories and coverage. I'm not sure if I or someone else originated it, but the word has certainly caught on worldwide today.
It certainly has, and even if you didn't coin it, many people today credit you with having coined it, so I don't know if you want to accept either the praise or the blame for that term, I guess. I don't know which it is, but certainly you have done a lot of incredible and groundbreaking research on this subject. So let's go back to the late 1990s when this subject first came to your attention. How did it specifically come to your attention, and what were some of the first things you did to start reporting on it?
I got a call from Jim Crabtree, the managing editor of Environment News Service, in the winter of 97, and he said, there's a resident out your way, Mr. William Wallace, out in Washington State, living remotely on the eastern side in the mountainous region of Washington State with his wife, Ann, and he sent a videotape, and he claims that some big airplanes are crisscrossing the skies overhead and laying down persistent trails that thicken and broaden over time and obscure the entire sky. And William Wallace said that he and his wife were getting sick. Their dog was sick. The plants were dying in their garden. So I said, okay, send it along. And after a while, I did get a copy of this VHS tape, put it in the machine, and watched it. And I thought, well, come on, these are just contrails. I've been a pilot, an ocean sailor. I'm well aware, as all of us are, of the normal condensation trails that spread behind high-flying aircraft, basically like breath exhaled on a cold winter day. Mostly brief phenomenon. NASA says contrails generally last 22 seconds or less, with some rare exceptions. But as I watched the tape, and it went on and on, I saw that these trails were not disappearing like normal contrails, and in fact they were spreading across the sky and coalescing and turning it into a murky haze. So that's how I started the story. Contacted Mr. Wallace. He gave me some other leads. Greg Hansen, a doctor down in California, Mr. Farmer out in Tennessee, and within a couple of months, I had hundreds of interviews and emails with people all across the United States, as well as in Canada, all claiming that they were seeing something very unusual in the skies, to the point where people were dragging their families out of their homes, stopping by the side of the highway, pulling over, aiming camcorders at the sky, not activities you would associate with normal aircraft flight patterns. So that's how the story began in early 98.
Well, when William Wallace wants to bring your attention to something, I guess we have to listen. quite a name. Well, absolutely, it is interesting how obviously at the time this was being taken as quite a new phenomenon, but of course now detractors these days will talk about how this is just a well-known and well-understood phenomenon that's been around for decades, and it's just and what we're seeing today is just an increase in flights and increased traffic patterns over residential areas, and therefore we are seeing more of this. But how do you address those claims?
On many levels. First of all, airline traffic has greatly increased in recent decades, no question about it. However, it does not increase overnight and then go away overnight. And by that I mean we are seeing these crisscrossing grid patterns, these X's in the sky, these parallel rows of these long-lasting, very bright plumes suddenly appearing in areas across the United States, Canada, and Europe that are not used to seeing air traffic on this or any scale. So first of all, there's a sudden appearance. It can go on for days or weeks and then suddenly stop. And again, this is not the mark of scheduled air traffic services. And I would add that most of these sightings take place far away from navigational beacons where aircraft do tend to congregate and crisscross each other. So the on-off aspects of this are one telltale that this is not normal airline operations. And as you rightly mentioned, we have lots of science on contrails, particularly military science. Of course, the U.S. Air Force is very concerned about dragging contrails behind their aircraft, which marks them for targeting by various weapon systems, particularly tankers. We're told by a major in the U.S. Air Force that U.S. Air Force tankers do not fly at high altitudes where contrails are visible for obvious reasons. They don't want to get tracked and shot down in a combat zone. Also, it makes it easier for fuel-hungry jet fighters to rendezvous with them at lower altitudes. So the tankers aren't flying at contrail altitudes where these things form. NASA and NOAA give us the science, and they tell us on their websites that condensation trails form in the upper atmosphere above 34,000 feet when the temperatures are very low, minus 70 degrees Fahrenheit or lower, super cold, and humidity is high, 70% or higher. So you have saturated, super cold air. Hot engines move into this, blow out hot exhaust particulates that momentarily condense into condensation trails. So that's the science. What people have done, including Clifford Carnicom down in Santa Fe, New Mexico, I went down there to visit him and other people down there, and this is an area known for blue skies every day of the year, and that simply stopped happening in the late 90s, early 2000s, and Clifford took the government data for temperature and humidity aloft on days of intense sky trail activity, and found that the air was far too warm, as we might expect, and far too dry for normal contrails to form. And we know that the only way you can form a trail in the sky behind an airplane in warm, dry air is to add chemicals to or particulate pollutants to the engine exhaust. And if you add enough of them, you can form trails. Now we're calling them chemtrails, chemical trails, in warmer, drier atmosphere. So the science is on our side. These experiments were repeated by Ralph Steadman in Houston, Texas, in the winter of 2000. And he looked at air traffic over Houston International Airport and used Flight Explorer software to identify the aircraft involved as commercial airliners or military aircraft. And he found over months of observation that the normal contrails by software identified airliners lasted again for on the average of 22 seconds, something around that order, 22 seconds, less than a minute in any event, with one or two exceptions where they lasted some 20 minutes. In the same skies at the same time, he tracked military aircraft, very large aircraft, leaving trails lasting 4 to 8 hours. So we have the same meteorological conditions and two very different responses by commercial and large military aircraft. That was fairly conclusive. Finally, we had a breakthrough in December 2000 here in Canada, where a citizen in Victoria, that's a city, the capital of British Columbia, just to the south of me here, called the airport and said, "What's with all these airplanes flying back and forth over the city leaving these trails? I'm afraid I'm going to get sick, or they're going to collide, or just what's going on?" And he received a call back from an airport authority, Terry Stewart. An actual airport official called him back and said, he actually checked with the Canadian military, and he confirmed this was a joint Canada-U.S. military operation. So at that moment, the airliner excuse vanished. It went away forever. We had an airport authority confirming this was military in nature. And that was confirmed a couple of years later. And here's a real breakthrough in this investigation, where a veteran radio journalist, S.T. Brent, out in Parsons Field, Maine, very rural, remote Maine, not used to seeing aircraft, having her coffee, looks out and sees 30 trails going back and forth over the house. Very odd. She calls up WMWV, her radio station in the city, and the assistant news director takes the staff outside, and they count 300 of these trails in the sky that afternoon. So S.T. Brent got on the phone, started phoning the air traffic control centers, and finally reached a man who would talk to her. He turned out to be the manager for air traffic control for the northeastern seaboard of the United States. We called him Deep Sky to preserve his anonymity, obviously afraid for his job and his family. He was also afraid that his family was going to become ill from these trails in the sky. And in three taped interviews, two of these interviews before witnesses at the radio station, he confirmed that U.S. Air Force tankers in commanded airspace, that is reserved for them alone, were spraying something in the sky, chemicals in the sky, that were reflecting on radar scopes and occluding them or obscuring them to the point where the controllers across the United States were being ordered to bring in commercial airliners underneath these tankers so that they could see them clearly on their radar scopes. And he confirmed that these tankers were flying north into Canada. He said that they were being told that this was a weather modification experiment. The controllers were later told this was a climate modification experiment. And the controllers became very concerned, again, about this fallout, these particulates coming down and making people ill. One controller even went to the local hospital on a weekend after heavy activity on her scopes, heavy spray activity, and was alarmed to find the emergency rooms jammed with people on this weekend. And in fact, in my initial investigations, I found the same thing. I had reports of jammed emergency rooms all across the United States. I mean, front page headline stories about this. And it wasn't the flu. The tests done on patients came back negative for the flu. The CDC in Atlanta said, we have an epidemic of mortalities. That is, an epidemic of deaths from whatever this is, but it's not the flu. So I think the air traffic controllers' concerns were unfortunately justified, and again, they were too afraid to come out, though we asked them to come public on this. But our source did allow us to play these taped interviews, and people can access some of those interviews and S.T. Brent's work on my website. You mentioned willthomasonline.net, and in my book, Chemtrails Confirmed 2010, which is an electronic download. And so it includes the first video done on chemtrails, interviews that I've just mentioned, as well as source document material, multimedia experience here. So there are some very strong arguments, including a federal aviation official in the U.S. confirming the presence of chemtrails, a Canadian aviation official confirming a military operation, NASA and NOAA confirming that contrails could not possibly be visible or linger in the atmospheric conditions we're seeing during summertime North American weather, and just the fact that these trails stop and start in conjunction with approaching weather systems, but not in any way that would indicate scheduled air traffic, which in any case flies A to B as efficiently and as much a straight line as possible and doesn't crisscross the sky in, I must add, illegal separation. That is, these planes making these patterns approach each other far too closely or even fly in formation. We have pictures of these planes in formation. That would be quite illegal for commercial airliners to attempt.
And once again, the name of the airport authority official in Victoria was William Terry?
His name was Terry Stewart.
Sorry, Terry Stewart.
And unfortunately for Mr. Stewart, he left a message on an answering machine in his reply. So I played that message on Coast to Coast. Some many millions of listeners heard it. It made quite a stir because, remember, up until now, the Air Force was denying it. The officials and debunkers were saying it was airliners. So when Terry Stewart said, no, it's a Canadian U.S. military operation, that is, the Canadians were tracking it, the Americans were flying it, it made quite a stir. And when Mr. Stewart subsequently crossed the Canadian-U.S. border, he was detained by U.S. officials and grilled for quite a long time. A very unpleasant experience, I'm sorry to say, for Mr. Stewart. But he did do all of us a major favor by taking this out of the airliner category. And again, that was absolutely confirmed, tragically confirmed. After 9/11, you'll recall that the entire U.S. commercial air fleet was grounded for 3 days after 9/11. And many of us watched the trails still being spread over American and Canadian cities during that time. And by definition, that could not have been airliners. They were all on the ground.
Do we have photographic evidence of that post 9/11 spray?
Yes, we do. I think I have some photographs in my book from Chicago in particular. I have a report from Bob Fitrakis, award-winning journalist from Columbus Alive, talking about where these were sighted across the country during that time. But we do have some photographs of this. I myself, here on the west coast of Canada, was in my kayak trying to make sense of this catastrophe and looked up and saw them right above my head. I didn't photograph it with a camera, but I certainly recorded it with my eyes.
Very, very interesting. Well, if we know what these are not, namely normal jet condensation trails, what can you say about what these are composed of, and how do we accumulate that information?
Our first clue came from a patent issued to the Hughes Aerospace Company. This patent was issued in 1994, and it was called the Stratospheric Wellsback Seeding for Reduction of Global Warming. Okay, well, what is that? Well, this patent talked about reducing or countering global warming by spraying Wellsback materials into the upper atmosphere. What's that? Well, sunlight-reflectant particles, aluminum oxide primarily the patent talked about. Other materials would be barium and quartz, commonly found materials, very highly reflective. And the idea that Edward Teller was proposing back in 98 was to spread a sunscreen in the upper atmosphere and reflect 1% of incoming sunlight, and that would stop global warming in its tracks despite an anticipated doubling of CO2 in the coming decades. Ken Caldera did the computer modeling at Lawrence Livermore for Teller. He hoped to prove Teller wrong because he thought this was a bad idea. By cooling the upper atmosphere, it would congregate CFCs and, in Caldera's word, quote, destroy the ozone layer. Caldera and other scientists were also very concerned about the health effects, again, of this fallout. Remember, the Hughes patent talked about particulates being added to jet fuel at 10 microns or smaller. Now, if you pluck a hair out of your head and look at it, it's 100 microns in diameter. So 10 microns is truly microscopic. And the EPA tells us that any particulate 10 microns or smaller is an extreme, their words now, extreme human health hazard. And by that, they mean regardless of toxicity, even a grain of sand, if it's 10 microns or smaller, can pass through the lungs, into the bloodstream, through tissues, and inflame the heart, leading to heart attacks, allergic reactions, crowded emergency rooms, for example. So this particulate size called for in the Hughes patent, very dangerous to human health. But unfortunately, Caldera's modeling showed that, in fact, if 10 million tons of this stuff, aluminum oxide primarily, was sprayed at altitude, this would not only reflect sunlight, but change the heat trapped between the upper atmosphere and Earth's surface into a far infrared frequency. That's the Welsbach designation. Actually change the frequency of this trapped heat so it would radiate back out into space. And so we had the Hughes patent giving us the tip-off, and the confirmation came, amazingly, in, again, 98. Just after I broke this story, I got a call from Ontario, and the citizens of Espanola, a little town in Ontario, Canada, were concerned because they were seeing aircraft that they had photo-identified as U.S. tanker planes crisscrossing their area, spraying something that occluded the sky, changed the sunlight, took it away, and apparently it made people sick, especially children, over a 50-square-mile area. They had never heard the word chemtrails. I hadn't even coined it yet or reported it yet. And they were simply concerned, and so they asked the Environmental Ministry of Ontario to do some air sampling tests, and that summer they tests were done. There was a public meeting called in August, and it made CBC, Canadian National News, across the country when a near riot broke out after the Environment Ministry refused to release their air quality findings. So the good citizens of Espanola petitioned Parliament to explain what was going on, and they finally got an answer from the Canadian military after 30 days, and the military said, well, it's not us, which was true. But they didn't get any other response. So Ben McNenley, a resident of that town, was noticing that people's moods were changing. They were forgetting where they parked their cars. This is a small town, remember. They were having all kinds of mental problems as well as the allergic reactions in sick children. So he gathered a sample of rain falling through these chemtrails and had it sent to a public lab, independent lab, paid for the test, and by goodness got the results back, and I have that lab test showing extremely high levels of aluminum oxide, 7 times higher than the government safety levels for Ontario, very high levels of quartz particulates, and surprisingly high levels of bacteria, viruses, and fungi also. And it appears that these chemtrails being sprayed at high altitudes are precipitating or bringing down to Earth colonies of virus, bacteria, and fungi that normally live and breed in the upper atmosphere and stay there. And so they are mutated by the ultraviolet at altitude. And if they're brought to Earth, precipitated out by, say, massive applications of chemicals, human immune systems have never experienced these critters before, if you like, and would have no immune defense against them. And that would make people very ill indeed. So there you go. We have the patent confirmed by lab tests in Ontario and subsequent lab tests as well.
Wouldn't high concentrations of toxic chemicals exceeding government regulatory standards necessitate some sort of investigation by the appropriate federal government agencies?
It certainly necessitated a reaction. The government raised the standards. They raised the level, permissible levels. That was their response. No, governments are not going to investigate themselves, and they're not going to admit to projects like this, especially when they're claiming that global warming is a hoax, it's not a threat, it's not a big problem. At least back then they were making this claim. They're not going to admit that it's such an emergency. They had to go to this very risky techno fix to try to ameliorate it, rather than, of course, cut CO2 emissions. But no, Ontario's response was to raise the acceptable levels.
perhaps not surprising, but still nonetheless disgusting. Well, you of course raised the specter of geoengineering as one of the, or perhaps the reason for this secretive campaign, and we've heard a lot about this from scientists like David Keith, who are being funded by Bill Gates to investigate ways of spraying the chemicals into the atmosphere to prevent global warming. But now we see study after study confirming that this type of spraying will actually increase the temperature, overall temperature. What can you say about this aspect of the agenda and the extent to which this might be even a smokescreen for other aspects of whatever the purpose of this campaign is?
Oh, boy. Well, first of all, again, Dr. Edward Teller didn't come up with this notion, but he popularized it again in 98. Interesting year, 98. We had a big surge in tropical fish appearing in northern Pacific waters, northern Atlantic waters. We had the first Category 6 hurricane ever recorded. So there was some kind of urgency. In fact, at the International Seminar on Planetary Emergencies, Teller stood up and said, here's your geoengineering angle. He said, let's deploy an aerial sky shield or sunscreen. It only cost $1 billion a year. The pilots are flying the planes anyway. And this is cheap and easy, and we can keep polluting as usual. So this was our official announcement of geoengineering in 98. U.S. government had looked at it previously. President Johnson had been advised this was a good idea, and he said, no, I don't think so. So, again, not a new idea, but Teller really pushed it hard in 98. So the geoengineering angle, the quick fix, techno solution, has now gained very broad momentum following the failed Copenhagen talks on climate change and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Those talks, of course, sabotaged not only by the U.S. government but the Canadian government as well, refused to go along with it. And isn't it curious that right after these talks failed, we got an onslaught of a massive geoengineering lobbying offensive by scientists, governments, corporations saying we can fix this by various geoengineering schemes, solar radiation management, the new buzzword. We've put up some solar reflective particles, or solar absorptive particles like sulfur. We spray 4 Mount Pinatubos a year, and we can absorb incoming sunlight. And, of course, create a hell of acid rain precipitation from the sulfur fallout. They never go into that. But the geoengineering is one major aspect. We had this confirmed, by the way, by scientists working on this project, Lawrence Livermore scientists, on loan to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Wright-Patterson, of course, the holder of the Tesla patents. Wright-Patterson, the coordinators of the HARP transmitter up in Alaska, the infamous HARP project. In December 2001, Bob Fitrake, as I mentioned, this reporter for Columbus Alive, interviewed a scientist, and he said there's two projects. One, we're spraying microscopic aluminum particles to reduce global warming in these characteristic crisscross patterns and grid-type patterns. The other project involves spraying barium chemtrails to direct HARP in Alaska for 3D mapping, electronic warfare, steering the jet stream, steering hurricanes like Katrina, things like this. So those were the two main aspects, the military aspect, to also bounce radar and radio beams over the horizon. Incidentally, to fly the drones in Afghanistan and into Pakistan, by remote control. Even satellite bouncing is too slow. So barium chemtrails, temporary antennas can be sprayed in the sky for this application. So those are the two admitted projects. I have sources in the military also telling me that maybe 1 in 100 flights, other things are being added to the mix. Chemical warfare simulants are being deliberately sprayed occasionally, intended to make people sick enough to see doctors, and that by this means the military, I'm talking U.S. military, and their scientists can track the dispersal of chemical weapons and their effects over a wide area. You mentioned my book, Bringing the War Home. In researching that book, I learned that chemical biological warfare is a very tricky thing to pull off. It has these organisms have to be spread at night. Rain dilutes them very quickly. If they spread at high altitude, the sun and UV can kill them and disperse them over too wide of an area, so they're not effective. The new generation of nano bio warfare does call for spraying at very high altitudes to, quote, take out entire nations. So very frightening technology being investigated on occasion, piggybacking on the chemtrails program. Now, I know that there's many websites and many people claiming that chemtrails are a population control measure, that this is a deliberate call, deliberately making people sick. In 12 years of investigation, I have found no evidence of this whatsoever. I do agree completely that chemtrails are making many, many people sick and even leading to deaths as an unintended consequence of this program. And I go further to say that since this has been well known for many years, and yet the projects continue, at that point you'd have to call it a deliberate trade-off. What's a few thousand useless eaters, the elderly I'm talking about, the immune-challenged children who would be perhaps terminally affected by chemtrails?
Well, absolutely. That's all very relevant. I assume that the scientists from the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory chooses to remain anonymous.
Yes, I don't know if they gave their names to Bob Fitrakis, but when I interviewed him, of course, he did not come forward with those names. Now, I did call Ken Caldera out at Lawrence Livermore, and I said, what do you know about this? He said he had no knowledge of this. In fact, he recently told the San Francisco Examiner, as far as he knows, the U.S. government has not actually begun a chemical spraying program to ameliorate global warming, as far as he knew. So I suggest that perhaps he is out of the loop. We have so much other evidence that this is going on. But that's his claim.
How about that document that you referred to about spraying entire nations with biological agents?
That came from a source. I've worked with a guy I call Hank for the last 15 years. People that go to my website will find many startling stories that we have broken together and have subsequently been proven correct. That is, stories that have been brought before the U.S. Congress, the British Parliament, sparked an emergency meeting of the Knesset in Israel and a public apology. Very, very rare for the government of Israel to issue a public apology, but in the light of the story that we ran on their attempted atomic attack on Tehran, they did apologize for violating U.S. airspace over Iraq. So my guy is very good. He holds on to his sources, of course. However, I'm able to corroborate much of what he says through other sources, and the rest is subsequently corroborated by the feedback we get. As soon as we publish stories, he gets a visit from two intelligence officers he's come to know quite well, military intelligence, show up at his house. Vatican representative shows up at his place. And so far, they have thanked us for outing these stories, because many American military officers, intelligence people, are very concerned about out-of-control experiments, out-of-control governments, and don't want to see Armageddon in our lifetime, or anyone else's.
As I'm sure no sane person does, absolutely. Well, very interesting. And I understand Hank has also provided corroboration for some of your recent posts about potentially new aspects of the chemtrail phenomenon, and that's nano chemtrails. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, the nano chemtrails came up about a year ago when the History Channel called me up and said, we want to interview you on chemtrails, and I had to do quite a bit of new research. And one thing I told them is that again, my source, Hank, had informed me that Katrina had been steered away from Texas using HAARP and chemicals sprayed into it to form a target or a handle, if you like, for the HAARP emissions. And much to my amazement, the History Channel found a U.S. scientist who confirmed this story, confirmed that report. So I was very gratified to have this corroboration from the History Channel. As far as the nano chemtrails, this is the latest, hottest thing where you get nanoparticles that are on a nano or atomic scale, extremely tiny and yet nearly sentient with electronic circuitry that enables a cloud of these particles to be spread like a chemtrail into storm systems or weather systems. But unlike an inert chemtrail, a nano chemtrail, if you like, can be self-directed, can swarm through a weather system, report back in real time on dozens of meteorological or scientific parameters and be tracked. And it's the hope of the U.S. Air Force and others involved with these projects that in time these nanoparticles can be ordered electronically to act on and interfere with, guide, disperse, or intensify storm systems. This is all very cutting-edge research. It's ongoing as we speak. The aircraft involved are not tanker planes. You can use a very small aircraft for nano-sized particles, and so drones, remotely piloted drones, are being used for this project.
As fanciful as that seems, I'd like my listeners to cogitate on the fact that this is all, in fact, actually quite out in the open, and we've seen DARPA calling for smart dust technology and to have every speck of dust on the planet to be engineered in a way with RFID and other microprocessors. So certainly we've seen the implementation of this being done, at least in experimental form, and it's, I guess, your contention that this is currently being done or is going to be done in terms of spraying?
Yes, well, both small-scale experiments that we know. Remember that whenever a government or military organization comes out and admits that something is being done on a small scale, they're talking years in the past, and you can be absolutely certain it's being done on a much bigger scale or more sophisticated scale than what they're currently admitting. So what they're currently admitting to are small-scale tests of these nanoparticles. Just a sidelight, but not really a sidelight here. I'm very concerned that I've done quite a bit of research. People visiting my websites or listening to me on radio will be familiar with my research on cell phone and wireless hazards. I'm very concerned that, if people are talking about a cull, again, a non-deliberate culling of the human brain en masse, cell phone and wireless radiation, microwave radiation in particular, is absolutely having great impacts, physical impacts, on our brain structure. And I go into all the documentation and science in my book, available on my website, my electronic book. Here's the deal on this. I've long wondered that if chemtrails being sprayed over U.S. cities are highly conductive, especially the barium chemtrails, be similar to the electrolyte in the battery in your car. You spray these over cities that are alive with microwave emissions and transmissions. It seems to me that chemtrails will conduct these very harmful emissions over longer distances at higher power levels and perhaps piggyback them into brand new unintended frequencies. Now, if we're talking nanoparticles or, as you say, smart dust talking to each other all over the planet, smart meters, I mean, on and on and on, everything's going wireless, we are going to be in a literal stew of wireless microwave technology. And that does not bode well for the human species, especially when we need our wits about us.
That's certainly true, and I certainly hope people will be looking into that through your website and other work on that subject, because it is extremely important, I think, at this point. And absolutely, I think even if people think that the chemicals being sprayed over us aren't in and of themselves harmful, they should at least be concerned about just the idea of blocking out sunlight, which of course is just such a vital part of the entire climate and not thinking about the reduction of photosynthesis and the lack of vitamin D and other just basic effects of even the sunscreen itself, let alone what the chemicals themselves may contain. So I think for anyone who is concerned, one of the things that's most concerning about this is there seems like there's nothing the average citizen can do about this other than to look up and take pictures. What do you say to people in their feeling of helplessness in this subject?
I would, again, say check out my website and follow the links to other websites. The good news in all of this bad news is that the recent calls for worldwide massive geoengineering, particularly solar energy management, chemtrails in plain English, has sparked an international outcry based in Europe and Greece. And if people want to know what citizens can do, they are doing plenty in places like Belgium, where the first international chemtrail symposium took place last May, May 28th to 30th. They invited people from across Europe to attend the symposium, and they invited aviation experts to put together a 300-page orange document, they call it, on the chemtrail phenomena, with footnotes and everything else. That document has been forwarded to the Human Rights Commission. It has been sent to The Hague. There has been an investigation launched by the government of Belgium into this phenomena. Greek citizens have been very vocal for years on the local government level. So there is quite a bit of outcry in Europe over not only chemtrails, but this call for worldwide geoengineering. And it's interesting that as they were meeting in Belgium last May, the United Nations was meeting in Nairobi, Kenya, to discuss extending its moratorium on ocean iron seeding. They want no more seeding of the oceans with iron particles, and they want to extend this to airborne aerosol spraying and similar earth modification efforts. So the UN will be meeting in October in Japan to consider this committee's recommendation. SBSTTA 14 is the designation, and they're calling for a worldwide ban on geoengineering. So things are happening on the UN level. This is what 193 nations have agreed to this. Things are happening in Europe, North America, Canada, the United States. We just don't seem to have, for some reason, the public outcry that you would expect in the face of the horrific civilian casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan, for example. We could go on all day citing disasters and criminal activity at government level that has almost garnered no response. And, of course, when people do turn out in the United States and Canada in massive protests, as they did before the invasion of Iraq in particular, biggest protests in history, the mainstream media won't cover it. So it's very difficult to get any kind of momentum, networking, and coverage through the media in North America, but the Internet is a great place for linking up with other people and groups. And again, I would recommend looking overseas, looking to Europe, and seeing if we can form allegiances with the HOME group, for example, Hands Off Mother Earth, the ETC group based here in Canada with offices all over the world, including Mexico City. Some of these groups I list in my article on the website. I put that back on the front page so people can go there and grab the links and check that out. But there is an international resistance to geoengineering. I'm very happy to report. It's been a long 12 years.
Very hopeful signs indeed, and I think that's exactly why the establishment media is dying such a long, slow, painful death, and why the alternative media, especially on the internet, is rising just exponentially at the moment. And hopefully we can continue that trend by getting real and valuable research out to people. So on that note, tell people a little bit more about your website and what they can find there.
At willthomasonline.net, you will find extensive reporting on many, many different subjects. And one thing that marks my reporting is that in my articles you will find just about every paragraph in brackets, the citations, the references for what I am saying, so that you can go there yourself, check it out, make up your own mind. You don't have to take my word for it. The other thing I like to do as a reporter is quote other people, other knowledgeable witnesses, knowledgeable experts in the field. So again, it's not Will Thomas telling you this. It's the top people in the field or people right at ground zero, eyewitnesses telling you what's going on. That's the kind of reporting I like to do, whether it's cell phones and wireless, chemtrails, photography, all kinds of things that spark my interest. Of course, the awful events in the Gulf, which, contrary to BP's reporting, is hardly over, not in the least over. You'll find that kind of reporting also on my website. Anything that the mainstream media is not covering or not covering completely, you will find covered extensively on my website. And though the articles are fairly long, you'll get it in one big bite. You won't have to go to 20, 30, 40 sources as I did to put these stories together. So you'll get it in one place.
And of course, people can purchase the digital download of the ebook Chemtrails Confirmed 2010, but not for Mac users like myself, I understand.
No, unfortunately not. I've really tried, and there's just no way to get these ebooks to open on Macs, unfortunately. I've got Days of Deceptions up there. The ABCs of Cell Phones and Wireless Hazards is up on the website. They're also available as DVDs, which you get a lot more, obviously, packed into a DVD than a download. But again, even the DVDs won't open on Macs. I don't know quite what to do with that. I guess there's emulation programs for Mac people that will emulate DOS operating systems. If it's worth the trouble, it might work. In fact, I'd be very appreciative of hearing from anyone who has that kind of translation software and has managed to open one of my ebooks. If somebody wants to try it, I'll send them a free link at no cost if someone wants to try that.
Excellent. Well, I certainly hope one of my listeners will take you up on that, so I assume they can contact you through your website.
That is correct. That is correct. Will Thomas at willthomasonline.net.
All right. Excellent. Well, Mr. Thomas, it's been great talking to you today, and I certainly look forward to your reporting in the future. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
My pleasure, James, and thank you for doing this. It's a great contribution. Thank you.